What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine.
Thank you so much for being here. I know you have other options. There are at least 7 or 8 other podcasts on the internet, so I appreciate you being here. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This is episode number 45, and I have been remiss. Now, one of the features I have in my blog is Friday Questions, where I ask you to ask me anything you want to know about entertainment, show business, life, dating problems, whatever. And I said I would, from time to time, answer them as well on the podcast. And it's been like months since I answered a question. So I'm going to try to do more of these in the future. And I thought today I would start off by answering a couple of questions. And then I want to address the World Series and the fact that, as you know, I'm a longtime Dodger fan. How do I feel about the Dodgers losing? And how do I feel in general about being a sports fan? And I know being a sports fan can enrich your life, but it can also destroy your life. Anyway, I'll talk about that. So a lot going on. I'm going to start answering questions right now.
Hollywood and Levine.
Okay, here is another Friday question, whatever day you happen to be listening to this. It's from Tyler, who asks, do sitcom directors tend to be more amused or irritated by repeated takes being blown by one or more actors in a scene laughing and giggling? Have you worked with any actors who got irked by co-stars who repeatedly did so? Well, Tyler, actors rarely get the giggles. They generally have tremendous concentration. So when it happens, it's usually very amusing to all concerned. And studio audiences absolutely love it. When I direct and this happens, I usually just give the actors a few minutes to regain their concentration, well aware that it's still going to take a few more takes before they can get through the line. You know, sometimes something will strike an actor funny, and he just gets the giggles. And he'll do the line 5, 6, 7 times, and he'll just break up. But it's usually infectious. So when that actor does it, then all of the actors do it. And again, you really just have to settle everybody down, take a couple of minutes. There have been a couple of times when I've just moved on and went back and just picked up that particular section of the scene after the audience left. And, you know, after a few hours, they'll probably be able to do it in 1 or 2 takes. Now, I remember one time on Cheers, we used Tony Shalhoub as a waiter, and he just pulverized everybody. Yes, it resulted in delays, but boy, was it worth it. There was an episode of Frasier that I directed called Roz and the Schnoz. If you haven't seen it, go find it. It's truly one of the funniest episodes. And it's not because of my directing, but it is one of the classic episodes of Frasier. And that is the one where, remember, Roz was pregnant. She was going to meet the parents of the father. And they came to dinner at Frasier's. And there was a lot of talk about how you can kind of get a sense from the parents just how the baby is going to look. And these two parents each had giant noses. And of course, the issue was her child going to have a giant honker like that. Anyway, it was very funny as we were rehearsing it, and I knew the audience was really going to love it. And I told my camera operators to just stay with whoever they were shooting at the time if they were about to lose it. In other words, the camera operators have assignments, and there may be like a line cue. And after David Hyde Pierce says, "Frazier, I want to see you for a moment," well, that camera gets off of David Hyde Pierce and goes to another assignment, maybe of Kelsey Grammer. But in this case, I said, if an actor starts breaking up, don't leave him. Just stay with him. We'll go back and pick it up later and get the correct shots. And so some of the shots that we ended up with in that show were absolutely priceless because you can genuinely see the actors trying to hold back the fact that they were just hysterical looking at these two actors with the huge noses. And I have to say, the two actors, it was Kevin Kilner and Jordan Baker, who happened to be husband and wife. And Kevin, of course, also happened to be the star of one of our series, Almost Perfect. But the two of them, somehow, with amazing concentration, never broke. They stayed in character the entire time. And there was no actor that I've ever worked with who had greater concentration than David Hyde Pierce, but even he was about to explode a couple of times. And I also had a similar situation where I was directing an episode of Just Shoot Me, and there was orangutan on the show. And of course, those guys are a little unpredictable. And the same thing I said to all of the camera crews, if the monkey does something really weird or different, stay with him and we'll pick up any pickups a little bit later on. And there was one scene in particular. Oh, and I said to the actors, just try to stay in character. Just try to react to whatever the animal is doing, but stay in character. So there's a scene where Wendy Malick is walking the orangutan into the office, and she goes up to the counter where David Spade is. And as they walk to the counter, the orangutan lifts up Wendy's dress and just peers right up between her legs. God bless Wendy. She stayed in character, and I just can't tell you how funny that was. Another time, she had to walk him across the set, and he grabbed a chair along the way and was dragging this chair. And when you see it, you say, wow, how did you get the monkey to do that stunt? It's just so funny. Well, it was just one of those things that happened. But again, I told the camera guys, if you see something that's really golden, just stay with it. The actors, most of the time, can keep their concentration and keep it together, although there are some actors who are better at it than others. I know Jimmy Fallon used to break up all the time on Saturday Night Live. And here's a sheepish confession. You know, there used to be network specials that aired these G-rated bloopers. And whenever they would air a blooper from one of my shows, I would get a nice royalty. So anytime there would be one of these bloopers, and I had a few of these on Wings, where at one point Crystal Bernard has a cake and drops it. Oh, just great stuff. And anytime that happened, you figure that the director's first thought would be, oh, no, now I got to do another take. It's going to take 15 minutes. No, I was thinking, oh, that's probably about $750 when Dick Clark uses that on his blooper show. Harvey Korman was a gifted comic actor, and he was part of the ensemble of the Carol Burnett Show back in the 70s. And he had a fellow cast member named Tim Conway. And Tim Conway could always break up Harvey Korman. And what they often did on the Carol Burnett Show, which was a variety show, is they filmed two versions of it. They would have like a 5 o'clock filming, And during those filmings, Tim Conway would play the sketches completely as written. And there would be an audience present, and then the audience would leave. They'd bring in a new audience after dinner. At 8 o'clock, they would reshoot the show. And sometimes Tim Conway would stray from the sketch in order to break up Harvey Korman. And it usually worked like a charm. And some of those scenes were just so priceless that they decided to use them instead of the actual written sketches. And there's one in particular, and if I've ever given you a homework assignment, this is it. Go to YouTube and look for the Carol Burnett Show dentist sketch with Tim Conway and Harvey Korman. Harvey Korman just cannot keep it together. I guarantee you, I swear to you, you will laugh hysterically when you see that bit. It is maybe the funniest sketch I have ever seen in my life, and there is no way that I can watch that sketch, and I've seen it, God, 15, 25, maybe 30 times. There's no way that I can watch that sketch without laughing hysterically. So go find it on YouTube, Carol Burnett dentist sketch or Tim Conway dentist sketch. It's there. It is unbelievable. Now, do actors get irked when other actors do this? Generally, no, because all actors go up on lines. So, you know, David Hyde Pierce goes up on a line 1 week, and then Kelsey Grammer is going to go up on a line the next. It just happens. Sometimes there are lines that you just have a mental block, or sometimes there are lines that you just can't get out for whatever reason. You trip over your tongue, and the more you try, the harder it gets. And once you get to take 6 and take 7, it gets harder and harder. I know on Golden Girls, I wasn't part of Golden Girls, but from what I understand, Estelle Getty had trouble learning lines. And it used to drive some of the other cast members like Bea Arthur and Rue McClanahan and Betty White a little crazy. But by and large, actors are pretty forgiving. And when there is a studio audience, it really does kind of break the tension. And it's one of the things for the studio audience that makes going to a TV taping so exciting, because you get to see something that you'll never see on television. And usually actors will have savers for it. I know Tony Randall would always turn to the audience and go, "At least I didn't say shit." But if a couple of actors go up on lines, hey, what the heck? It's fun. It's a comedy. You're doing show business. So what? So a guy goes up on a line. In a sense, that's the beauty of doing a multi-camera show in front of an audience, because as opposed to a play where you get one chance to do it right, if you screw up, you can do it again. So actors tend to be a little bit looser. So that is the answer to that question. Coming back with more right after this. So this one comes from listener Bevo, who asks, why did you guys leave MASH? And the reason is, well, we left at the end of season 7. And when MASH began back in the early 70s, Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds, the creators of the show, spent an awful lot of time doing research. They interviewed tons of doctors and nurses and corpsmen and people who had spent any time at all in Korea during the conflict. And all of those interviews were transcribed. Most of the stories came from those particular interviews. And obviously, they were altered a little bit for creative effect. But still, most of the stories that you see on MASH all come from research. I think it's one of the reasons why the show is so good and why it is so authentic. Well, by the end of season 7, we had pretty much picked those bones clean. We had done a few subsequent interviews, but again, we're starting to hear the same stories because people had the same experiences. David and I were the head writers in year 6 and year 7, and back then we had very small staffs. I mean, that really started at the beginning when the real writing staff of MASH for the first 4 seasons was Larry Gelbart. He pretty much wrote the entire series for 4 seasons. How he did it, I do not know. It's why he is a genius. It's why he is Mozart. We would be fried. Still, we had a couple of other people on the staff pretty much helping out for rewrites. But David and I, especially season 7, pretty much wrote or rewrote every episode of the season. I think we wrote 7 or 8, maybe 9 of the episodes ourselves and rewrote everybody else except Alan. We didn't rewrite Alan too much. We just kind of dusted his scripts off a little bit. But everyone else, we rewrote extensively. David and I also came up with all of the stories. MASH is very difficult to plot. Usually we had 2 to 3 different stories going on at the same time, and they all had to dovetail and come together at the end. And like I said, it was pretty intricate. So instead of trying to explain the theory and the way we worked to other writers who we had sent out to do scripts, it was easier to just come up with a story ourselves, write the outline ourselves, and then just talk the writer through it and send him off to do his first draft. So that meant through the course of a season, and we did 25 episodes in 1 year, and we filmed them from July 4th until Christmas. Now, by comparison, today, a half an hour single camera show, and maybe they'll do 22 episodes instead of 25, and they will be filming from the end of July until the end of March. Well, we did it all in 6 months, so it was just a sprint. We would have 2 to 3 stories, like I said, in each episode, so that meant between 50 and 75 different stories were used each and every season. We got to the end of season 7, and we figured, you know what, we have done every hot show, every cold show, every visiting general, everyone has slept with everyone else, we've had every kind of shortage, any kind of leisure activity has been interrupted by helicopters with casualties. We had pretty much, we thought, exhausted any story potential that we had. And also, at that point, none of the characters could do anything that surprised us. We pretty much knew how every character was going to react in every situation. And the one problem with MASH, the one conceit, remember, MASH lasted 11 seasons, but the actual Korean War lasted about 3 years. So MASH lasted like 3.5 times longer than the actual conflict. And we had to keep the 4077 in the same time, in the same space. Now, normally when you have a situation comedy and it goes over a period of 7-8 years, well, characters get married, characters have kids, they move to different apartments, they change jobs. There are things that you can do to just kind of keep the show fresh. But with MASH, we were sort of locked into this time and place. And so at the end of 7 seasons, we were, like I said, pretty fried. And then NBC came along and made us a big, sweet deal to do 2 pilots, one of which they promised to make. So we decided to leave, although we did come back in season 8 and we wrote the 2-part Goodbye Radar episode, which was his swan song and it was our swan song as well. And looking back at it, we probably could have gone 1 more year. But the series lasted 3.5 seasons after we had left. So even if we had stuck it out and done 1 more year, we still would have been in the same spot because there's no way we could have done 3.5 more years. So that's why we left MASH Although I will say, and I have said it all along, that I could not be more proud than I am of being associated with MASH. I mean, that is like being with a Super Bowl winning team year after year after year. And I remember a number of years ago on 60 Minutes, there was a feature about ageism. Writers were saying in order to get work, they were taking their MASH credit off of their resume. And my feeling is, boy, the day I have to take MASH off of my resume is the day I quit the business and sell ties at Macy's. As a sports fan, you are expected to live or die by your team. Or if you're a Seattle Mariners fan, die and die by your team. But the point is that you ride the highs and you suffer with the lows, and it is a long-time commitment, a lifelong commitment in many cases, for you and a particular team. But the question is, at what point does it start ruining your life? And I have been, as a lot of you know, a longtime Dodger fan. Not only that, but I worked for the Dodgers. I hosted Dodger Talk for 8 years on the Dodger Radio Network. So I have, like, bled Dodger blue since the Dodgers first came to Los Angeles in 1958, and I was a little kid, and I was just enamored by the sound of Vin Scully and all of the great Dodgers. And, of course, it didn't hurt that the second year that the Dodgers were in L.A., they won the World Series. So it's like, oh, okay, this is easy. Yeah, well, they haven't won a World Series since 1988. And it continues. But there was a pivotal point in my life, and it really changed me as a sports fan. 1962, it was the first year that the Dodgers were at Dodger Stadium. I was 12 years old, and they were having a dream season. They were pretty much leading the National League wire to wire, and that was the year that Sandy Koufax really came into his own, and Drysdale was winning 25 games, and Maury Wills was breaking Ty Cobb's stolen base records, and Frank Howard was hitting 35 home runs. Tommy Davis was the batting champ. Like I said, it was really a dream season. And then it all came crashing down the last couple of weeks, and the Giants caught them, and it resulted in a 3-game playoff. And the Dodgers lost the first game, they won the second, and the third game, the elimination game, was at Dodger Stadium. And the Dodgers were leading 4-2 going into the ninth inning, and the Giants scored 4 runs. And we're talking the hated San Francisco Giants, partly because Dodger reliever Stan Williams was wild and walked in a bunch of runs. Dodgers lost that game. They lost the pennant, and the Giants went on and eventually lost the World Series to the Yankees. But I was devastated that night. I was so crushed that I couldn't eat dinner. I was inconsolable. And then about 8 o'clock at night, like one of those aha moments, when I thought to myself, wait a minute, what the hell do I care? I mean, at the end of the day, this doesn't change my life in any way. I'm not making any extra money out of this. I'm not getting any kind of a contract. What does this mean, you know, to me? And at that moment, that very instant, I changed as a sports fan. And yes, I remained a fan, but never again did I allow myself to be so distraught, so paralyzed, and to put my fortunes in the hand of an athletic team. And that has served me very well. So when the Dodgers lost to the Houston Astros, by the way, as much as I love the Dodgers, I thought the Astros were the better team, at least during that 7-game stretch. But still, I was disappointed, and I just turned off the TV and went and did something else. You know, it's like I was able to eat dinner. And I think that's kind of what you need to do. Okay, sure, I throw some furniture around and break things a little bit. But hey, everybody does that. But the point is that you have to be a sports fan in perspective. Because if you are a longtime fan, over time, your team's going to win. You know, there's going to be parades. It's going to be very exciting. You're going to see these guys pouring champagne on each other's heads. And then there's going to be times when you're crushed. You know, you're going to be a Boston Red Sox fan, and the Yankees are going to come back, and Aaron Boone is going to hit a home run and destroy your season. And then Boston is going to come back the next year down by 3 games in the American League Championship Series, and they're going to come back for an improbable victory and go on to win the World Series. Okay, crazy things happen. And another indication for me was Game 5 of the World Series, and that was that Sunday night marathon that the Astros won 13-12 in Houston. Well, at the time, I was in New York, so I was on the Eastern time zone, and I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was a wild-ass game, and when it was over, yeah, I was disappointed that the Dodgers lost, but I was so exhilarated. My primary thought was, wow, that was a great ride. That was a really fun baseball game. So it's like I'm a baseball fan first and then a Dodger fan. And I think, again, for all of the Dodger fans who are still smarting, I think you got to take that perspective, okay? I mean, Vin Scully, for 67 years, called Dodger games. Many of those seasons ended in heartbreak. And he always said that the Dodgers do it the hard way. And we kind of took that to be the case. In other words, yeah, love them anyway. Well, I don't think the Dodgers are unique in that at all. I think all teams at times do it the hard way. But for all you Los Angeles Dodger fans, I know it's going to be a very long winter, but you still have the Los Angeles Chargers. Oh, one final thing about that playoff game in 1962 that the Dodgers lost to the Giants. So years pass, and it's now 1992, so we're talking 30 years later, and I'm broadcasting for the Seattle Mariners, and we happen to be in Kansas City. And I'm in the press box dining room, and my broadcast partner, Dave Niehaus, comes over with a scout. Dave knew all of the scouts. Dave knew everybody. So the scout sits down, and Dave introduces him to me. Hey, this is Stan Williams. And Stan Williams extends his hand. And I had a tough time shaking his hand. I'm thinking, Stan Williams, you walked all those fucking guys. But I did. I shook his hand. And, you know, and he seemed to be like a really nice guy and everything. But, oh, man. Old wounds. That dinner I was able to eat, actually. Actually, several dinners, because the food was really good in Kansas City. Anyway, that's my rant on being a sports fan. Back with more right after this. All right, that will do it for episode number 45. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, and Randy Thomas. Now, if you have a question, and I am going to try to answer more of them, honestly. You can always email me at HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Again, that's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Ken Levine. I'm also on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. And if you could, still, I would love a 5-star review. For whatever reason, they say that really does help. Okay, thanks so much for listening. I will see you again next week. Bye-bye.